Friday, July 23rd, began as a fabulous visit into a page of America's past history that is fast disappearing from the scene. Mrs. Marjorie Post is a member of our beautification committee, and she has made a gift of $5,000 plus an offer of plants from her lovely home, Hillwood. Because she's asked me in the past to come out and walk around the grounds if I would like to, even if she were not there, I decided to go so that I could write a more understanding thank you and learn something of the plants that she might contribute for the squares and triangles and parks in Washington. Something hopefully that can be kept together and carry her identity along with her money contribution. Tony had arrived fresh from about 5 or 6 weeks in 4 South American countries for AID. He met me at the White House about 10 o'clock, and we set out for a 2-hour excursion into fairyland, Hillwood. The mistress absent at her home in the Adirondacks, where apparently there's a sort of a constant turnover of a house party. There's another home in Palm Beach, and there used to be the 300 or so foot yacht, the Sea Cloud. But this lovely Hillwood is home from about April through June, and then once again in the fall to Thanksgiving or Christmas. It's a surprisingly large wooded area, some 27 or so acres, I believe, on Linnean Avenue, close to where we used to live. Remote, sylvan, secluded, and right in the middle of residential Washington. Commander Ault, who apparently manages Mrs. Post's properties, met us together with the gardener, Mr. Earl Loy. The house itself was closed most formidably, with great steel or aluminum slabs bolted all over the outside doors and windows, and men at the gate with uniforms that said Hillwood Police, which set a certain air as we entered. Commander Ault never had 2 more appreciative visitors. I'd been to Tregaron. I'd loved it and the sudden vistas of the cathedral through the trees. And here I found another vista from the front porch of the house on an absolutely direct line as though drawn by an engineer. The front door looks at the Washington Monument. Wonderful selective cutting of the towering trees has made just the right vista, like a stage setting. I commented on this to Commander Ault. It was perfection. He smiled and said, when Mrs. Post bought the house, we moved the front door 32 inches to get that effect. The great sweep of the front lawn was dominated by a flagpole with a ship's yard arm across it to remind them, I suppose, of the Sea Cloud, and at the base, a plaque with the name of many of the 200 employees who work on Ms. Post's house and grounds. It was a gift from them. And all around, a border that has changed 3 times a year. Tulips in the spring, in midsummer, begonia, white and flame and pink, and periwinkle and verbena and marigolds and azuretum, and in the fall, chrysanthemums. And then there's a Japanese garden with arched stone bridges and a waterfall that finally ends in a pool around which, almost hidden, you come upon small stone figures, a turtle, a heron, a grasshopper, and a frog. And the pool is crossed by stepping stones made of grist wheels. Japanese lanterns hang in the trees. There's a very ancient one of stone from a temple. The whole thing was truly a fairyland. There was even, in a secluded spot, a little dog graveyard where her favorite dogs, for the last many, many years, were buried. Some had been brought from other homes. There was a friendship walk. Small statues nestling in the shrubs, the four seasons around a flagstone terrace, the names of donors at the bases, this nation's great, the past several decades, justices, cabinet members, society's names. I noticed the Tom Clarks among them. And a little plaque, a garden is enchantment, with Mamie Dowd Eisenhower as the donor. And then vast greenhouses. There's so much behind this facade of beauty. For instance, when she is in residence, it takes about 200 pots of azaleas for use in the house itself. It was greenhouse after greenhouse for orchids alone. I remember the lovely ones she sent to the White House. I've accepted them all too casually. There should have been a glowing note about each one. Of course, the nicest thing to remember is that she opens this up for benefits. For the symphony, for a series of concerts for the young, all sorts of cultural and civic things. And now, for me, that must be the sweetest expression I can make of my gratitude for her handsome gift and an exploration of what we can do with the plants she has to offer. They turn out to be a cuba, small variegated box, and ilex. No great number, but if they could be combined into a well-tended, beautiful, small park, a square or a triangle, together with her gift, how much her interest might be stirred. And she could, if she wanted to, be such a figure in this. Commander Ault, it turns out, has been with her more than 30 years, back through at least 3 husbands. He was hired by Mr. Hutton when he was doing the engineer work for the Navy on building the Sea Cloud. And he knows how to find an Italian sculptor to reproduce a particularly beautiful garden piece that turned out to be just plaster of Paris, or a machine that will sterilize all the topsoil to be used in the hothouses so there won't be any weeds, or how to move a doorway 32 inches. I couldn't help but think of Ed Clark's story. Rich folks have such pretty ways. She has certainly shared hers with the people of Washington, and I've heard that she's going to leave the house and everything in it as a museum to the Smithsonian or some such organization. We came for an hour and spent nearly 3 and returned to the White House in time for a sandwich and some soup in my room, and then upstairs for a nap for Tony. I worked with Liz and Bess, and then the beautiful day grew black. I was supposed to do the inviting for people to go to Camp David with us for the weekend. I misunderstood. I invited some that Lyndon had been thinking about, but that, as it turned out, he couldn't really discuss business with them if he was trying to discuss it with others. So I was crushed, feeling that I had messed up not only his relaxation, but his attempt to work on the blessed weekend. And then there was the question of what should I do with my 4 o'clock appointment to go to see the David Lloyd Kriegers, possible donors to the beautification program, and owners of an art collection that I really wanted to see. Any minute we might get off to Camp David. Should I take the chance? I decided I would. Tony and I drove out to the Kriegers about 4 o'clock. It developed they live within a couple of blocks of where we lived happily for 18 years, and I expect Beagle was one of their constant unwelcome visitors. I carefully avoided his name. It was a quite simple house, really. The most astonishingly wonderful collection. An apricot and gold and blue and green seen above the fireplace by Bonnard that I fell in love with. A Woman with Long Hair by Renoir. A dreamy floating Monet, so like the one at the White House. Picassos that I think are right fresh out of the madhouse. Statues that I make no pretense to understand. Bizan, Van Gogh, Corot. The most marvelous collection, especially considering they've only been at it, really, for about 8 years. They were charming people, and I enjoyed them just as much as I did their collection. Philip Johnson is building a house just to suit the collection. All glass and arches and gardens on Foxhole Road, close to Mrs. Kafitz's. They were easy and pleasant. And I would have adored to stay, but I was on pins and needles, knowing that people were accumulating at the White House. So back we rushed at 6 o'clock. To find the Goldbergs already in the yellow oval room with a cup of tea, Peter Hurd arriving, I'd phoned him to come up and we'd take our chances on getting sittings. This further complicated my weekend, because it's sort of like asking Lyndon to take castor oil. And Mary Margaret, nurse and baby, standing out front waiting for the helicopter. I told them to please go upstairs to the second floor and be comfortable. Got Peter Hurd established in a bedroom, and then took him with Tony on a tour of the first floor to look at all the presidential portraits to see what sort of backgrounds they used, what sizes they were. I want us to work toward a bust size of about the same as the Thomas Jefferson portrait. And perhaps in the background a sort of symbolical capital, because the hill was my home, Lyndon has often said. It played a more than a quarter of a century role in his life. I told Peter we would bring him out to Camp David in the morning at 9 o'clock for his sitting. Time passed, and I'm glad to say Justice Goldberg got a nap, so Dorothy told me. But at 7:50, we got the signal to come quick, and we were on the helicopter, Tony and the Goldbergs, the Valentes and Buzz, Vicky and her date, Dennis. This time, when we reached Camp David, I wanted only to get into slacks, seek the solace of a drink, curl up on the sofa, and listen. It had been a day full of magic and excitement and learning, and I'd been glad to share it with Tony, to watch his delight, but I could only feel that I had made Lyndon's time more difficult by not really understanding his plans for the weekend, and so I was tense and on edge. After dinner, I watched a movie, Mirage, with Gregory Peck. Everybody else went to sleep, except Buzz and I and Vicky and her date, and then to bed, but it was hopeless. After midnight, when I couldn't go to sleep, I came out in search of a book, found Brownstone Front by Lewis Auchincloss, and went back and read until 2:30. The light wakened Lyndon. He put his head in the door, said, "Can't my darling sleep? I'm so sorry." So I put a blanket across the crack between the doors, read a little more, and then turned it out. It was a short night. I waked up at 5:30, with the birds chirping for dawn. For an extraordinarily healthy, tough, reasonably happy person, sleeping is becoming the hardest thing for me to do, particularly when I feel that I have not played my role well, that I have been a hindrance and not a help. For Lyndon, the day had been a constant diet of Vietnam with Secretary Rusk, McNamara, General Wheeler, Mac George Bundy, and others, and the fact that the poverty bill had passed, that there had been many pluses in the legislative achievements of the week, had not prevented Vietnam from dominating the news. All the lineage, all the stories. Bill Moyers is being sensationally good, everybody agrees. At dinner, we discuss Stevenson, and one of the favorite subjects of conversation around Washington these days, Schlesinger's book, LBJ versus RFK, the story of who said what on the fateful day when the decision was being made about who should be vice president. And the nasty little thing that Schoenbrunn claimed Stevenson had told him. Goldberg says, "We're all grippers to an extent. You come home and gripe to Lady Bird. I go home and gripe to Dorothy. We've got to blow off steam somewhere." Stevenson was tired. He was frustrated. But I don't for one minute ever believe that he thought or said a moment's disloyalty to the administration or the president. Lyndon told the story of how Stevenson had come to him and told him he was thinking of running for the Senate in New York State. That was in the spring of 64. And what did Lyndon think about it, he asked. Lyndon said, "I think it will be awful. You were made for this role you're in. I just don't want to think of anybody else in it." Stevenson, somewhat taken aback, "But is that what you really want me to keep on doing?" Pitilessly, Lyndon said, "Yes, I do." And Stevenson never cast a backward glance at the Senate. He went right on in a job for which he was, in theater terms, perfectly cast.